The hair trigger can cause a gun to fire quickly, easily, and cause unintended damage. The same hair trigger could be found in the way the few find offense in what's enjoyed and important to the many. That's certainly true regarding TV and, oh, I don't know, the occasional radio show. We've also seen how this hair trigger has spread to religious liberty and freedoms, where a believer could be attacked for simply practicing a spiritual tenet. The response to this supposed outrageous act is the attempt to shut down that offending element as much as possible. My next guest recently wrote about this battle and its consequences in the column of Bloomberg.com entitled "The Left's Doomed Effort to Coerce the Right." She's a Bloomberg View columnist, author of the book "The Upside of Down: While Failing Well is the Key to Success." Megan McArdle, thanks for being here today, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And Megan's website is the obvious, MeganMcArdle.com. And what you are focusing on in your column is a story of, you know, it sounds innocent enough, a couple of hosts on an HGTV show. You know, it's not Meet the Press or MSNBC or anything, you know, issue-oriented. It's the hosts of a renovation show. And I guess you could say that there were some who took offense to, can we call it guilt by association, because of who the pastor of the church is? Was that the foundation of this whole uproar?
Yes, basically. So BuzzFeed wrote an article in which they looked at the church that these two people attended and what their pastor had said about gay marriage. And this was a kind of novel innovation in the culture wars. You know, we've seen things like Brendan Eich of Mozilla, who was basically forced to step down from his job because he had given to an anti-gay marriage campaign. You'd never seen one of these campaigns where literally all of the evidence was just they attend this church. And that's a really worrying development, right? For a long time, we've been having these debates over how should, now that gay marriage is the law of the land, how should we treat anti-discrimination law, for example? And as evangelicals and traditional Catholics, other traditional religious groups have said, you know, we need space carved out for religious liberty, people have said, no one is questioning your religious liberty. This is about if you participate in public, right? If you are doing commercial transactions, then you have to abide by the law of the land. No one is trying to threaten your freedom of worship. Well, this is pretty much entirely about their worship, right? This is not about anything. There's not alleged that they discriminated against gays. BuzzFeed did ask the question, you know, would they allow gays on their show? They're in Waco, Texas. It's not really clear that they hadn't, but it's also not really clear anyone had applied. And, you know, it would be fine to investigate whether they had kept gay couples off of their show, but, you know, the investigation starts with a question. You don't write the article then. You write the article after you found out the answer. And it was troubling that this article even ran, because it sort of speaks to an attitude, I think, among a lot of the left that is about saying, you know, we have to aggressively pursue this. And the result is that evangelical Christians and other traditional religious figures feel that they're under a kind of existential threat from the left, that between things like the Hobby Lobby case, where a company was forced to provide what its owners think are abortive fashions, the Little Sisters of Poor, where nuns were being forced to provide birth control as part of Obamacare. And, you know, the government did back down, but only because the Supreme Court made them. And, of course, the Supreme Court was at issue in this election. And so what I've heard from evangelicals is, look, I hate Trump. I think he's terrible. He's bad for the country. But I don't have a choice, because I am under existential threat, and I have to vote for the guy who's not actually going to try to sort of legislate or privately harass my church out of existence.
Trump is a proponent of the appealing of, it's called the Johnson Amendment, which prohibits churches, pastors from doing anything, even insinuating anything political from the pulpit, which, again, some people argue is a limitation of speech because, you know, I mean, where does a pastor become separated from the Constitution because of his or her role or title? I mean, that's the part I think that is maybe the most frustrating part. Yeah, they're a leader, they're a pastor, they are a practitioner of the First Amendment as far as, and in addition to religious freedoms, but yet they keep falling under this attack of, you must be limited, you can practice what you preach, just don't let me hear it or see it.
You know, I think that there are some fair questions about things like that, because, for example, churches enjoy extremely wide latitude in our society They enjoy tax exemptions. They enjoy other kind of exemptions from various laws, not just, sexual morality discrimination, but other things about employment that they don't have to follow and everyone else does. And so, you know, we've extended those things because we're saying, look, your religion, you're special. But it may also be fair, and I think this is a conversation that America has to have, to say, look, we've given you this special status, but you can't then use this special status to start organizing politically, right? And indeed, you know, Jesus said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. So these are not, you know, I think that what we've lost on both sides is the thought that we have to compromise, right? That we live in a big pluralistic society. And that means that secular believers, people, you know, those people need their space. We have to talk about liberty for people to pursue their version of the good. But that includes religion, and that means that the left also has to compromise and say, yes, you know, I would rather live in a world where no one thought gay marriage was wrong, but I can't go after that, you know, that world by threatening people's livelihoods, that is going to upset this delicate balance that we in America have always struck between the many, many people who believe many different things, and that discretion is the better part of valor, and live and let live is a much more workable recipe for a functioning republic than attempting to achieve total victory through a combination of government and private coercion. And we are not there yet, but we need to get there because the culture wars are not going away and they are doing terrible things to our politics.
So Megan McArdle, who wrote a column for Bloomberg at Bloomberg.com, The Left's Doom Effort to Coerce the Right. She's also author of the book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. MeganMcArdle.com is her website, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. The thing, too, with the people who are going after any public expression of religious practice, right, wrong, misunderstood, confused, whatever the case may be, how hypocritical is it of them, of those being the same people who, if the Nazis want to hold a march and a rally, you have to give them the rights. If the Ku Klux Klan wants to sponsor a Clean Up This Mile of the Highway program, you have to let them. I mean, it just seems like they're selective in their tolerance.
I think that's always true, and that has always been true, right? You know, it's always easier to tolerate. With the joke, I can tolerate people, everyone except the intolerant. Well, that's not really tolerance, right? And I think that if you look at things like, some people have asked, why aren't any Muslim bakeries being targeted by these discrimination cases? And those are legitimate questions, right? And I think that people do, but, you know, I also think we have to be more tolerant of this sort of stuff, too. I'm not saying we shouldn't fight it. I am trying to in my column. But we have to understand, look, the government is made up by people. People are imperfect. We don't need to demand perfection from either side. What we need to demand is the ability to live together. And I think that this election and what has come out, and I'm not saying just because Trump was elected, I think that I have been covering politics for, more than a decade now. And I'm more worried about the country than I've ever been because there is this sense that no one seems to be able to come to any sort of compromise with the other, and compromise is always unsatisfying. You know, I'm a libertarian. I'm a pretty hardcore libertarian, and so I would like a much smaller government and so forth. But then we had things like the government shutdowns, which were really counterproductive and didn't even achieve the goal. It was just this kind of expressive, well, I hate government, so I'm going to put the country's credit rating at risk. And now you have people talking about on the left, well, can we play games to shut down to somehow get Merrick Garland, President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, could we somehow play this technical game where after the old Senate is dismissed, before the new one is sworn in, we could use the 66 people who are still there, which would have a Democratic majority, to get rid of the rules and approve him? But this kind of stuff is toxic. And the hatred that people seem to feel for their fellow citizens is toxic. And we need to find a way to back down, to de-escalate, to say, look, I wish you believed differently, but you don't, and that's okay. We have to live in the same country. Neither side really seems very willing to do that at this point.
And you also have the people who are threatening the electors, the Electoral College electors, making death threats at them unless they flip their votes from Trump to Hillary. So, I mean, that just – and you mentioned the evangelical votes before. There was some research done, and there was about 10 million, quote-unquote, evangelical votes, non-evangelical born-again voters. That was good for 33 million votes, and they're called notional Christians. They're not born again. They're not really that intense, but they consider themselves to be Christians and followers of Jesus Christ. That was 58 million votes for Trump, and that was the anomaly because that was the section of Christian voters that were heavily Democratic voters since 1996. So that was the big flip, and maybe that's evidence, too, of just how concerned Christians at all levels are with the tenor of how at least they consider they're being treated and impacted by the will, the wishes, and even the demands of the few.
And I think one thing that you're really seeing here is that I live in my husband was raised in a very religious town. He went to a small religious college. I am the exact opposite. I was raised on the Upper West Side of New York, and I live in Washington D.C., which is a pretty secular place. And I think that for a lot of my friends who are secular liberals, or secular libertarians for that matter, this stuff just, they don't even realize it happened. And that's something that, that's kind of a structural problem with our media. But I will say to them, look, people really feel like they're under existential threat here, and there's all this stuff that's happened. And they will just kind of look at me and say, like, what? This is just whining. This is just trying to keep their privileged status. And I'll say, no, this is real stuff. That they're worried that their schools are going to be put out of business. They're worried that they're – and they don't know that it happened. They forgot, partly because, you remember the stuff that's really important to you. If you are a Christian and you're worried that your religious school is no longer going to be able to teach and enforce on faculty and students a traditional version of sexual morality, then you know that Gorton College had its accreditation threatened over that issue, which would have meant the loss of ability to take federal student loans and probably the college shutting down. You are well aware of that story. If you're a secular liberal, maybe you read one article about it once and probably you never heard about it. Even the stuff like Hobby Lobby and Little Sisters of the Poor, the way that liberals kind of perceived and framed those cases was about whether employers could enforce their version of morality on people, which to me was always a very strange notion, right? Buying birth control is not that expensive. And the idea that somehow if my employer decides not to cover it in insurance, I will just not be able to have birth control and that will be the end of it, right? That was a little bit crazy, but that was how it was seen. Or as about making a symbolic statement about how much you love women, which again is, you can love women and also be against certain forms of birth control or indeed all forms of birth control. I think the Little Sisters of the Poor who don't want any birth control probably love women. But because of that, because there's this huge disconnect between how these questions are framed and how people understood that liberals didn't even understand the extent to which they had pushed conservative Christians into a corner where they felt like they had no choice but to fight berserk. And I've heard from so many people, so many evangelicals, so many traditional Catholics, who say, look, I hate Trump. I hate what he says. I hate how vulgar he is. I hate what he says about race. I hate what he says about women. I hate all of the stuff that, the sexual harassment stuff and so forth. But he's not trying to destroy me. And I'm really worried now that the left, if they are not checked, are going to destroy my community. And the fact that liberals had picked this fight and pushed people into feeling like they had no choice but to vote for a presidential candidate, so they weren't just, as we often are with our presidential candidates, kind of he's okay, but had to vote for someone that they really fundamentally disliked and often had voted against in the primary and vehemently said they'd never vote for. That was something that liberals didn't even understand they'd done. It wasn't even that they had decided to pick this fight and they lost. They didn't realize they were picking the fight.
Her Bloomberg.com column, The Left's Doomed Effort to Coerce the Right. She's also author of the book, The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Her website, MeganMercardle.com. Megan, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.